of a street address. And, you know, that's the ploy. And we have been saddled with stolen elections, certainly since the year 2000, where the Democrats continue to blame Ralph Nader, who had absolutely nothing to do with Al Gore losing that election. Al Gore lost it himself after having won it. John Kerry did the same in 2004 and Hillary Clinton in 2016. Until we have an actual opposition party in this country that's willing to stand up for the right to vote and the right to have those votes counted, we're in deep, deep, deep trouble. Okay. And this next 2 years has to be about the progressive takeover of the Democratic Party so that, can, among so much else, we can actually have reliable elections.
All right. Harvey Wasserman, again, we thank you for the good information and the great reporting. We're going to keep an eye on this. We're going to be talking over the next couple of days and weeks to figure out what the hell happened in this election. Thanks for joining us on this special edition of Flashpoints. You are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Keep it locked.
I don't know if I know all the words or not, but I'm going to try to sing it for you.
In celebration of our 50th anniversary, KABU is teaming up with the Mississippi Records Music and Film Series. KABU will be hosting Wild in the Streets on Wednesday, November 7th at 7:30 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater in Portland. A freaked-out 60s exploitation movie, Wild in the Streets follows Max Frost and the Troopers, a psychedelic rock band that managed to take over the United States after the voting age is lowered to 16. The new regime legalizes all drugs, puts everyone over 30 into acid re-education camps, and creates a new hippie fascist utopia. Again, that's Wild in the Streets on Wednesday, November 7th at 7:30 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KABU Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Gorge Wine Weekend event starting Friday, November 9th in locations around Hood River, Oregon. Gorge Wine Weekend celebrates the completion of the harvest season with 3 days of events including library tastings, picnic parties, vineyard tours, and much more. Again, that's the Gorge Wine Weekend event starting Friday, November 9th in locations around Hood River, Oregon. More information can be found at kabu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Yeah, that's KABU, KBOO Portland. Coming up next, it's the bike show with a couple of guests and lots of talk about bike talk. Okay, hang on, please. Here comes the bike show.
It takes two wheels and no gasoline to keep yourself healthy and to keep the air clean. You can ride in the sunshine, you can ride in the rain. It takes two pedals, two wheels and a chain. Everybody, ride your bicycle. Let's get together and leave our cars home.
Good morning and welcome to The Bike Show, broadcasting from the KBO studio in Portland, Oregon, and podcasting at bikeshow.portlandtransport.com. Our engineer today is Tammy Dean. Thank you, Tammy, as always, for your assistance. My name is Alon Rab, and I'm joined in the studio by April Streeter. Good morning, April.
Good morning.
How are you doing today? How are your loved ones?
I'm doing well and happy after 2 months of bike-free living to be back on my bicycle.
Okay, may it continue.
Thank you.
In today's show, we will hear of monarch butterflies and also of bicycle sprockets, of milkweed plants, and of spokes. In the first half of the show, we will talk with biologist Sarah Dykman, who followed on her bike the migration of the monarch butterfly. In the second half of the hour, we will be joined by British science journalist and author Max Glaskin, whose book Cycling Science sheds much light on why the bicycle works so well. Before we introduce Sarah Dykman and hear of her work, a few quick news items from the cycling universe.
Okay, there's a New York Times story that asks, can Paris exist sans gasoline? Its mayor thinks so. If Paris socialist mayor Anne Hidalgo's plan becomes reality, one day driving a gas-powered car through Paris will be but a memory. But you will be able to breathe. Last year, Hidalgo set a goal of ridding Paris of all cars except electric vehicles by 2030. She expressed the hope that all good citizens would trade in their gas guzzlers willingly. Hidalgo's predecessor and fellow socialist, Bertrand Delanoy, closed a left bank section to traffic year-round. Hidalgo did the same on the right bank, citing the importance of maintaining the city's aesthetic integrity and its clean air. Hidalgo envisions a time when cyclists, pedestrians, kids, and the wheelchair-bound will move freely and without fear. The desire to rid Paris of dangerous street-hugging private vehicles dates back to 1790, surprisingly, when an anonymous pamphleteer claimed that pedestrian rights were human rights.
And Charlie Gundel, a British teenager trying to become the youngest person to cycle solo around the world, has had his bike stolen in Townsville, Queensland, Australia. He usually camps out, but this time he stayed at a hostel. He woke up on day 103 of his journey to find that his bike, which he named Colin, his camping gear and passports were gone. Refusing to get depressed, Charlie decided to take a trip to the nearby Magnetic Island, later sending a hopeful message to his supporters. "Amazing day," he wrote, "seeing wild koalas and feeding the birds of paradise. I do love Australia, and one bastard isn't going to change that option. Have a great day with whatever you're doing, and don't stop ever."
Finally, our own special BikePortland.org reports that Portland Street Medicine, a team of medical doctors, social workers, EMTs, and volunteers who provide free care to people who are homeless, has several powerful new tools that will allow them to reach more people. Bicycles. Donated by the Splendid Cycles bike shop owners Barb and Joel Grover, the bikes will provide easier and quicker access to places that are hard to get to. Since February, over 400 patients have been cared for, with about 20 people reached a day. The bikes will allow meeting at least 10 more people daily. For more information about this awesome project and how you can help, go to portlandstreetmedicine.org.
Okay, and our first guest today is biologist Sarah Dykeman. Sarah has recently completed a very long journey following and observing the monarch butterflies' migration and sharing their wondrous lives with school kids. Good morning, Sarah, and welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And where do we find you today? Where are you on your travels?
Well, I finished up my migration about a year ago. The fall migration this year has been really awesome, but I have actually been in California just getting updates about the eastern population's migration via the internet, and I am trying to continue the adventure by writing a book, which is probably harder than biking.
That seems so. Was there any good news about the migration this year in terms of numbers?
From what I've read and heard and talked to folks that I stayed with when I was biking, the fall migration saw really big numbers, and people were seeing hundreds roosts, thousands roosts in their backyards, and people seemed fairly promising that the numbers are bigger than the year before.
Awesome.
And before we get to the journey itself, tell us a little bit about the monarch butterfly.
The monarch butterfly is so special, and I could go on and on about it, but the basics are there's two populations. There's an eastern population and a western population divided by the Rocky Mountains, and I followed the eastern migration, which is one of the longest insect migrations on the planet, and it happens to be multi-generational, which sets it apart. So basically, the monarchs that leave Mexico, where they overwinter in colonies, millions strong, so many monarchs concentrated together that the branches will break from their weight, and they overwinter in Mexico, and then in the springtime, usually around March, they start flying north, where they lay their eggs and die. And it takes two to three generations to make it all the way up to Canada. And the generation born in the fall somehow knows not to keep going north, but instead to fly back to the forest in Mexico that his or her great-great-grandparents lived on. And there's so many symbols of the monarch. They're North American. They don't see borders, so they're Mexican, United States, and Canadian. They connect people living in New York City to tiny farms in Kansas. They're very democratic in their reach. And I think they have a lot of lessons to teach us.
And what promoted you to follow the monarch butterflies and not whales or, you know, bison or humans?
The best thing about monarchs, as far as a cyclist wanting to follow them, is that there's millions. And by the time they hit Texas in the spring, they really start spreading out. So their range, where you can find them, extends basically from the Rocky Mountain front to the Atlantic Ocean. So there is a concentrated corridor, but the great thing about monarchs is I basically could pick any road in Kansas or any road in Minnesota. As long as I was there at the right time, I was going to see monarchs.
Wow, that's incredible. And so step us back just a little bit to how you decided to take this particular journey. I now can see why the bicycle is a perfect vehicle for the journey, but what prompted you what prompted you?
I love bicycle touring. I've done lots of bike touring in the United States and in Latin America. And I also love animals. I especially love animals that other people are like, eh. So my favorites, I'm a biologist. I study frogs and snakes and turtles. And I think that they have a lot of beauty that we don't see because we don't look. And the monarch happens to be beautiful, but it's in the same world as all the other insects that people kind of shy away from. So I call the monarch a gateway bug, because the monarch gets everyone excited. And I wanted my trip to get people excited about all those animals that live with us that we don't appreciate and that we miss out on because we're not looking. So I decided I'm going to follow the monarchs. And the other reason I chose the monarch is because they're already connected with schools. Kids across North America raise them in their classrooms and can learn a lot about science by being part of their lives. And one of the things that's really important to me when I go on bicycle adventures is to bring my adventures into classrooms. So I stop and give presentations along the way to students from little kiddos in kindergarten all the way up to college, and I did adult presentations as well. And I just want people that might not have time to go on a 10-month journey to still be a part of my adventure and to still get something out of it.
And how do they navigate? I mean, how do they know where to go, how to come back?
It's still a process. It's still a science that we're learning. But when they leave Mexico, scientists hypothesize that the monarchs follow the Sierra Madre Mountains, which run northwest through Mexico. And then when they get to Texas and start fanning out, they're going north and using the poles and the magnetic poles to go north. They're also using the wind. They'll fly thousands of feet up in the air and take advantage of wind currents. And then when they go back in the fall, having never been there before, it's obviously a bit of genetic memory. And they'll follow the Sierra Madre Mountains again south. And the mountains that they live on in Mexico are volcanic. And so when the volcanoes erupted a long, long time ago, they brought heavy minerals up from the middle of the earth, and there's some of those minerals are magnetic. So the monarchs actually have scales on their wings that are magnetic, so that not only can they follow and reach the poles, but they can also hone in on the magnetism of those mountains.
I find that completely fascinating. I want you to talk a little bit about milkweed and how that, it being the monarch primary food, the only food. But first I need to ask you a super practical question, and that is, what do the monarchs do when it rains as far as being on their journey? And then what did that do to you? Because, I mean, I'm not a cyclist that enjoys riding in a heavy downpour, although I will ride no matter what the weather. So I'm wondering how that worked out on your own journey.
The monarchs typically don't fly if it gets cool at all. So they will just hunker down in a tree at night or when it's raining with a storm. I was a little bit more, I had to meet presentation deadlines, or I had to be in certain places at certain times. So when it rained, I usually just got on my rain gear and kept trucking.
Wow.
I also took that opportunity every time to be like, ha ha ha, I'm like beating the Monarchs, because it's sort of depressing, but they're definitely faster than me. And so anytime I could gain a little ground, I was happy about that.
Wow.
And do they have any, are there any predators, any dangers that are posed to the butterflies?
Only humans.
So the Monarch caterpillars only eat milkweed, which you just mentioned. And it's the only food source. There's quite a few different species of milkweed, but the females will lay one egg on the underside of a leaf. That leaf will hatch, and then it will have, the caterpillar will have this buffet to just chow down on. And the milkweed is poisonous, and most animals avoid eating it, but the milkweed has evolved ways to not only survive the poison, but to store it in their bodies. And as they eat the milkweed, they become more and more poisonous themselves. So that's why the Monarchs are bright orange. They're warning people, or they're warning potential predators, that when they were caterpillars, they ate poisonous milkweed and they became poisonous. So the caterpillars have quite a few predators. Among them, there's spiders and ants that eat them. My favorite is a fly that will lay its egg on the caterpillar. The fly egg will hatch, burrow into the caterpillar, and the larva will eat its insides. So it's not all fun and games out there. But like you were mentioning too, the biggest issue that the Monarch faces is human encroachment. Every single time the Monarchs make their migration, there is less and less habitat for them. There's less milkweed, there's less native nectar plants they need. There's cars and highways that they have to cross, and climate change also plays a big role in their migration and how changing just a tiny bit of the cycle really affects the whole thing. So they're up against a lot of problems, and I think one of the things we can learn from them is every single person can help, and every single garden that people plant, every single leaf adds up and helps. So, like I was saying, they live in New York City, they live in Kansas, and every single person can plant a garden and be part of that solution and sort of try and give them a future.
So you mentioned nectar, and so do the Monarchs, once they are in butterfly form, are they pollinators?
They are pollinators, and it's a little unclear as to how important they are as a pollinator species.
Mm.
I say that recognizing that humans don't know anything and we're still learning, and if we remove them, we still don't honestly even know the ramifications.
Mm.
But it's not the most important reason to keep them around. You know, bees pollinate a lot more crops than monarchs do.
Mm.
And when you present and talk in schools, what kind of interactions do you have with the kids? Does it, you know, your talks, do they promote kids to plant more milkweed?
So when I go to schools, I focus on the adventure, I focus on science, and I focus on conservation, and I incorporate stories to get kids thinking, about their potential trips, to show students what a real life scientist looks like. Like, we don't all wear white lab coats, and we're not all, you know, in a lab. Some of us wear jeans, and we're crawling around in the grass and getting paid to find frogs.
Mm-hmm.
So I really want to just be an example. One of my favorite stories I tell students is how I was on a highway in Mexico, and I see a motorcyclist in the distance, and he's getting closer and closer, but as he's getting closer, he's going slower and slower. And I start thinking, uh-oh, what does he want? And everyone in the room is always like, oh no, she's in Mexico, there's someone coming. And I like to tell this story because what happens is the motorcyclist stops right in front of me to give me free ice cream. So I have lots of stories like that that help paint a different picture and help be a voice for not just the monarch, but for lots of different people living on the route and for all the people that are being part of the solution.
Yeah.
You are listening to the Bike Show, broadcasting from the KBO studio in Portland, Oregon, and also available as a podcast at bikeshow.portlandtransport.com. We're speaking with biologist Sarah Dykman, who recently completed a ride from Mexico to Alberta, a solo ride, but she was accompanied by a few million monarch butterflies.
So I have a question about how you built your route and how you got hooked up back together with the butterflies when your courses, for time reasons or weather reasons, were your courses diverged a little bit. So I'm wondering if you had any methodology. So how did you plan your route first? Did you have points? You said you had points you had to hit for the schools. And then did you have any method that you could get back together with your butterflies when you were separated?
The number one resource I used was an organization called Journey North.
Hmm.
And Journey North is a citizen science collaboration where people all over North America can submit their first sightings of monarchs. So I had 10 years of data and maps showing me where monarchs were typically in March and then April and May. And I could use that data to sort of plot my route. I also made a route and then talked to some scientists who helped me tweak it and make it better. And then in the end, a lot of it was a bit of guesswork and going to places I wanted to go.
Hmm.
Luckily, like I was saying, the monarchs spread out, so I had a little bit of leniency. I had a little bit of give. And then during the migration, the population becomes staggered. So if a monarch lays an egg in the shade, it's going to take longer to develop. And so that means that the monarchs are hatching and flying at different times. So really, from Kansas to Canada, I had the opportunity to see them pretty much all summer.
Hmm. And you also hiked across the United States and canoed across the length of the Missouri River. Can you tell us a little bit about those journeys?
Yeah, I like long journeys. I'm not fast, but I can just keep going forever. My first trip was a hiking trip, like you mentioned, and I did the canoe trip because I was like, I've seen the country by bike, I've seen the country walking. I wanted to see it from another perspective. Every time you change how you travel, you get a new perspective. And since this is a bike show, I'll plug biking is the best. But on our canoe trip, we also brought our bikes, which is pretty fun. And so we had two canoes with our bikes stacked up high, and we had bicycle trailers, so we could actually hook our bikes up to our canoes and pedal to school presentations and also use them to portage the dams. So the bicycle played a important role in that trip as well.
Hmm. And can you, what's next for you?
Well, like I said, I'm trying to write a book. The whole point of my trip was to be a voice for the monarch and shine a spotlight on what we all need to be doing and what people are already doing. And so I thought, well, a good way to do that would be to write down my stories.
Yes.
And share them that way. So I'm working on that, which is a whole nother adventure in itself, and sort of just like taking the time to think about what's next. I'd like to follow another migration, but there's not a lot to choose from that a bicyclist can do.
Yeah, that's what makes it so cool.
The whole future is wide open, and we'll see.
Okay, sorry, Alon.
No,
I was
going to
just follow up a little bit with the idea that we were saying that a milkweed garden or a milkweed highway, we didn't talk about that much yet, but I guess it would be great to get specific details of, like, what should I do when I'm planning my garden next spring to contribute what I can to the duration of this monarch caravan.
That's exactly it. Plant milkweed. There's monarchs on the West Coast as well. What's the easiest, most straightforward thing is plant native plants in your garden. Native plants are going to attract native pollinators, they're going to attract native animals, and they're going to return some of our planet back. And so planting natives in your yard means you're sharing the planet with all the creatures that were there first. So there's lots of resources online, and there's lots of groups that sell native plants. And just start small, put a few in the corner, and expand and start to notice all the animals that are there only because you shared that space with them.
Hmm.
And we have a couple of minutes before we have to say goodbye. And I'm curious about your own background. You know, how were you always a cyclist? Were you always interested in animals? What is your background?
I've always loved animals, and I've always loved biking. When I was 7, 8, 9, I would see how many times I could bike around the block without my hands. That was pretty cool. And then I loved to just bike and get lost. And obviously my like 10-year-old adventures were like 3 miles away, and they were epic and hard and super satisfying. And I just fell in love with like proving to myself how far I could go.
Wow.
And I also just have always loved frogs, and I've always loved finding frogs in nature and just helping other people see the beauty in them. I just can't emphasize enough how beautiful nature is if we look at it, and how so many people just go through their lives and don't ever give them a chance to just see how wonderful the world is we live in.
Hmm, I agree. That's awesome. It's been inspiring to listen to you talk. I think maybe we should kind of close up from where we started, because we jumped into that the numbers of the migration seem to be good this year. But it would be great if you wanted to summarize how over time the numbers in the migration have decreased, and that's still a serious issue that we all need to maintain our awareness of.
Right. So all natural populations in the wild fluctuate year to year. The problem is that over the last 20 years, the fluctuation in monarchs has had a downward trend, trending towards zero, which when I tell kids, zero means extinct, gone forever. The monarch isn't in danger of extinction, but the migration is. And that downward trend is very scary, because one freak storm in Mexico or one bad year in Canada could have detrimental effects.
Mm-hmm.
So while we're having a little bit of good news, we're not out of the clear, and we just really need to keep pushing hard to provide the monarchs what they need so that we can get to a level that's more sustainable.
You are listening to The Bike Show. We have been speaking with biologist and educator Sarah Dykeman, who rode along the migration path of the monarch butterfly. Thank you, Sarah, for your valuable work for ecological sanity, for the preservation of the wild, and we wish you much success with your future projects in life, and also much success to the monarch butterflies. May their magical flight continue.
Thank you so much. I wish I had a bike bell so I could.
And good luck with the book.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. In the second half of the show, we will be joined by British science writer Max Glaskin, whose book, Cycling Science, How Rider and Machine Work Together, sheds much light on handlebars, brakes, helmets, gears, to name just a few elements, and how they work to make the bicycle the incredible machine that it is. Good morning and welcome back. You're listening to The Bike Show, broadcasting from the KBO studio in Portland, Oregon, and available also as a podcast. In the studio are April Streeter and Alon Robb. in the second half of the show. We're happy to have as our guest Max Glaskin, author of Cycling Science, How Rider and Machine Work Together, published by the University of Chicago Press. The book is a treasure trove of useful information about why bikes work, the science and engineering behind cycling, and the science that keeps a bicyclist in the saddle. Glaskin is also the co-founder of the United Kingdom's National Mountain Bike Organization. Good morning, Max, or in your case, good evening, and thank you for being on the show.
Good evening and good morning.
Okay, good morning, good evening, good day. Before we get to the science of cycling, I'm curious about your own background and also maybe some of your earliest cycling memories.
Oh, wow. If only I could remember way back. I guess I started, like most as a kid. My parents gave me a tricycle to start with, and eventually I moved up to two wheels, and didn't really do much, I guess. I used a bike just to get around, see friends, go out and explore beyond the reaches of where I could walk. It was a bit of freedom, as ever. With young people, it's a good way to get out and go see new places.
It certainly
then,
is.
I guess I had to get a bicycle. That's it. I got a job on a newspaper as a cub reporter.
Wow!
And I had to follow fire engines, and the quickest way to do that was to get a bicycle. I tried that and finally got myself a job on a bicycle magazine. Mm. And was writing about bikes there, and then something new came in, something called mountain bikes.
I think I've heard of that.
you have. That changed everything over here. Well, I was lucky enough to get one of the first mountain bikes. With a friend, we rode what were probably the first mountain bike expedition over the Greater Himalaya.
Incredible.
Probably get to that shortly. And I thought maybe you'll say there are very tall mountains in the United Kingdom, but so maybe in Wales.
We haven't got anything that compares with yours, I think, sadly.
So, okay, then take us from a cub reporter cyclist and then mountain bike and enthusiast, and then how did you segue into getting interested in cycling science? Or were you already, from working on the magazine, kind of delving into cycling science?
A little bit, but mostly we were getting other experts in to write about science and engineering of bicycles. It was only because when I left the magazine, an engineering magazine asked if I would write an article about the use of aluminium in bikes, because in those days, aluminium frames were just coming through, taking the place of steel frames. So I wrote an article for them, and they liked my writing style, and they commissioned me to write more and more articles about engineering. I wasn't an engineer. I'm not a trained engineer. I'm a journalist. And so I started to speak to engineers, and they told me a lot about different engineering, and that then some newspapers asked me to write about some engineering stuff and then some science stuff. So I started talking to scientists, and over 30 years I wrote an awful lot of science, and finally, I guess about 8, 9, 10 years ago, somebody from the old days of early days of mountain biking winkled me out and said, "Hey, I know somebody who wants a book written about cycling and science, and you know about both." So I thought, "Oh, do I? Okay, I wish I'd had that idea." And so that's how I came to then start delving deeply into the science of cycling and writing the book Cycling Science.
And what is the most surprising scientific fact that you uncovered about a bicycle?
Oh, gosh. Well, the fact that they still don't really know why a bicycle stays upright.
I was hoping you were going to say something about that, because I was going to ask you, what is there anything after all this work in the cycling and the science side, is there anything that's still mystical about the bike? And you brought it up right away, so thanks.
Well, it is incredible that thousands, millions of people ride bikes, and they know so much about the insides of atoms. They know so much about the far distant reaches of the universe, the edges of the universe. They know so much about the depths of the ocean and the inside the human body, and yet they still don't know exactly why a bicycle stays upright.
Wow.
It's not done with wires that are held to to some plane in the sky or something, to a cloud?
I think you may be onto something there.
Maybe we could write about it.
Yeah. Okay, so back to the surprising fact. So are you saying that that's the most surprising fact, is that we don't really know yet what keeps a bicycle upright? We know pieces of it, but we don't have all of those pieces.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, 5-6 years ago, a team of four physicists came up with the closest that we've ever got to knowing what why a bicycle stays upright. All the different things to do with the geometry and the centers of gravity of the different parts of the bicycle, but they still haven't defined it precisely. There's still unknown areas. They did manage to come up with a formula, which you're probably familiar with it. I think it's got 23 different terms in it, you know, X, Y, Alpha, Z. But that still hasn't pinned it all down. And every so often, somebody comes out with another little piece of the jigsaw. Whether they ever will absolutely pin it down and give it total definition, I don't know. If they manage to, then it will allow people to design different kinds of bicycles, because they can just slot different numbers into the formula and come out with a different shape of bicycle. Already, one team has done something with that. They've come up with a bicycle which is stable, stays upright, even though the steering is on the rear wheel, not on the front wheel, just by using the formula that's getting quite close to knowing everything.
That's fascinating.
That surprised me. And in the end, you think, well, do we need to know? Maybe we can get some better bikes, more efficient bikes, weird bikes that we've never seen before, nobody's ever thought of. There's thousands of things that we still don't know about cycling altogether. And I know that because every week there's maybe 50 academic papers relating to the science of cycling published in the academic journals. So they're still finding out a lot.
And how efficient is cycling, and what is the most efficient design?
Well, if you want to go as fast as possible or use your energy most efficiently, it's got to be a recumbent, you know, one of those laid back, sometimes called bent bikes, just because the thing that stops you, saps most of your energy once you're going over more than 8, 9, 10 miles an hour, then it's the air resistance. We need air to breathe, obviously, but it slows us right down, even when there's no wind, headwind, or it still takes a lot of energy to push the air aside so that you can make forward progress. It's not quite quickly. Half of your energy is being spent pushing the air aside so you can go forward.
So what that leads me to is a question about, so why don't we see bicycle races being run with recumbent bicycles? Or, you know?
Yeah, good question. It's historical. And it's really because back in 1933, an amateur, not quite amateur rider, but he was a very lowly ranked professional rider, suddenly set a new record, world record, for distance cycled in an hour. And he did it on a recumbent. And this upset all the manufacturers who had a vested interest in producing conventional shaped bicycles. So the manufacturers persuaded the regulatory body, the UCI, Union Cycliste Internationale, to put a stop to recumbent bikes being allowed in competition. And UCI still carries, still is in charge of everything. And I was at, I was moderating at a conference about 2 years ago in Brussels, in Belgium, and the technical director from the UCI was there, and the question was asked, you know, is there ever going to be recumbents in professional cycling so that they can race faster, more efficiently? And he basically, he shook his head.
It sounds like a scandal on the magnitude of the FIFA scandals. Speaking of air, so what is the role of, let's say, helmets or clothing in improving speed? I mean, are there any new garments, sort of like the skin-tight clothes that swimmers were using and that were very controversial?
Yeah, sure. There's been a lot of investment, particularly among the professionals. It starts always at the professional racing cyclist end. They've been developing clothing, not just body tight and figure hugging, but also so that the seams are all in the right places so they don't spoil the airflow, so you don't spoil the little vortexes of air, the tiny little ones just holding you back, so that the air slips over you smoothly. It's not just the seams of the garments that have changed, though, but it's the actual surface of the fabrics have changed. In some places, they will actually want to create little amounts of turbulence on around the body when they're crouched forward over the handlebars and riding as fast as they can. Some of this little bits of turbulence actually prevents other vortexes from larger forces that prevents them from holding you back further. And now, well, there was a guy, Len Brownlee, who came up with something initially just for foot athletes, road runners, their clothing had little kind of diamond patterns on them, and that made the air less of a drag on them. And then it suddenly popped up on cycle clothing a couple of years ago for the first time, and people were questioning that. So a lot of investment gone into that because clothing sales are a big part of the cycling industry, cycling accessories. Possibly shops make more money out of clothing and accessory sales than out of bike sales. The margins on profit margins are higher.
I have a question about how bike geometry it might relate to gender. It was fascinating that you're saying that a recumbent is the most efficient bike, and that makes me think that possibly we've been designing bikes all through the history of bicycles for more for the male side.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think you're right there because it wasn't until a few years ago I first became aware of it in the late 80s. People started realizing that they should design more for women. But you could be right. Certainly, saddle design has had to get better to make it less painful, less awkward. Mostly for women, for some men as well. I don't know about hip flexibility, whether bending forward to hold drop handlebars is harder for women. They've shortened top tubes to make them fit women better. But yeah, maybe a recumbent with one of those seats, like a bucket seat, is more comfortable for women. I know my wife, who isn't a cyclist and doesn't like riding on bike saddles, the only bike she's enjoyed has been a recumbent.
And two elements, two parts of the bikes that always interested me, spokes and also bearings. What exactly do they do? How do bearings reduce friction? And would bicycle spokes that tend to break sometimes, would you design a bike that has no spokes, for example? Would that be better, more efficient?
Yeah, well, you can, let's see, bearings, they reduce the friction, particularly if they're properly lubricated. The initial bicycles or the prototypes of bicycles just had like a metal ring which the hub went through and rubbed against, and that wasn't very good. But bearings cut down the friction overall. They are a source of some friction, and unless they're lubricated well, they're going to work against you. As for spokes, you need the spokes to keep the rim attached to the hub. You could replace them. There are some which have just three or four large spokes, and that's for a carbon fiber rim, and they're integral with the rim. You could have a solid disc wheel, and that there are some of those as well, used for time trialing mostly. They're not for most people. They catch the wind. If there's a side-on wind, they can deflect you. And they weigh a bit. And steel spokes are really the ideal solution.
Maybe we should switch over a little bit to how cycling science has, what it's told us that's most important about how the cyclist's body is working and behaving, specifically maybe how a cyclist's muscles behave or how a cyclist's body works.
Yes. Well, cycling uses the strongest part of the body, the thighs, the upper legs, and it positions us, well, if the shape of the bicycle has evolved to position us in the most efficient shape possible, in the most efficient position, so that our thighs are free to just turn the cranks of the machine, the pedals. They don't have to carry our weight. That's the trouble with walking and running. Our legs have to carry our own weight, lift us up and down with every step that we take. But cycling, we can just sit there and let our legs just go around and do it.
So for the common transportation cyclist, what's the most effective way that science is indicating that we can ride faster or more efficiently?
Just make sure in the right gear that works for your energy levels. If you can reduce your exposure to oncoming wind or to reduce your air resistance, I would keep any luggage behind me. Avoid putting racks and panniers and bags on the front wheel or on the handlebars. And otherwise, the best way to make yourself go faster is to smile.
And that uses a couple of muscles also. Max, I'd like to switch gears, to use a cliche here, just for a second, and ask you a little bit about your own riding. You mentioned the Himalayas. What was that like, and can you tell us about that?
It was phenomenal. Now, I come from a country where we don't have mountains more than 1,000 meters, 300, well, there's one 4,000 feet. That's about it. So to go to a place where the mountains are 15, 16, 17, 21,000 feet high, was inspiring. And to get on a bicycle and find a route through these mountains, over and up and through the passes, the high passes, was amazing. I'd never, we did it with a friend and colleague called Jeremy Tor. We did almost no planning whatsoever. We didn't know what we were going to. In fact, the first time we tried to get up, the snow was covering the whole place and we couldn't get anywhere near. So we had to just cycle around the lower levels for 3 or 4 weeks before returning. And even then, there was still about 3 or 4 miles of snow we had to cross at the highest pass. It was frightening at times. There was one night when we were camping just on the snow, and I was just going to sleep, and I said to Jeremy, "Hey, can you hear that waterfall?" And he said, "There aren't any waterfalls." And then we realized they were avalanches.
Yeah.
So we didn't sleep that night.
No.
And in the morning we woke up and we could see clearly that we'd pitched our tent on an old avalanche cone.
Well, I'd like to hear a little bit more about your travels in the Himalaya and also the bike ballet you participated in. But we have a caller online, Mike, who would like to ask you a question. So thank you, Mike, for calling us, and go ahead, please.
It's not so much of a question, but my postulation that the reason why we can be on bikes is for the same reason that gravity and balance, you know, has its ratio in space. So we are always falling in the sense of gravity, everything we do. And then it's the question of the trajectory sideways or in any direction that counters some of that force. So when you see somebody at a corner balancing on a bike who's particularly skilled and can stand there for 10 minutes, what they're doing is they're just resisting the falling by managing the movement in direction counter to the gravity. So as you roll, it's kind of like you're always falling, but you're falling in line in the balance in direction and pulling away from that perpendicular direction going below you. So we're always falling as we roll, but we're controlling it with our balance, but we're always moving and falling.
Thank you for that explanation. That was really, I could visualize that in my head.
Cool. Max, yep. What do you think about Mike's theory here?
That's spot on, Mike. Yeah, that's great. What the scientists and physicists haven't pinned down is why a bicycle stays upright on its own without a rider on it if it's going above a critical speed, usually about 7 to 8 miles an hour. If you give a bicycle a good push, it will roll along and stay upright, even if there's no rider on it, moving their weight about to keep it balanced.
Hey, Mike.
Huh? And Mike, do you have something more to add? Or I guess he's off the line. Well, thank you, Mike, for that very insightful observation. Back to you, Max. So the Himalayas, avoiding avalanches is something important to do. And so you were one of the founders also of the Mountain Bike Association in the UK?
Yeah, well, that's when we came back from the Himalayas. We set up the Mountain Bike Club because we realized there was nothing for people to do on their mountain bikes apart from go and have fun. We didn't want to stop them having fun, but we wanted to help them know where better to have fun and to put on special events. And we ran the national series of mountain bike events for 5, 6, 7 years. And eventually, the suits moved in, and the big money moved in, and we well then mountain biking became successful.
Yeah.
So, but that was a lot of fun, and it was great to be at us with a sport that was in its infancy, and to help get it moving and popular.
Okay. I want to go back to one thing that you were talking about when I was asking the question about efficiency, and you were saying to gear properly. And that kind of just triggered something in my mind where I'm thinking about, you know, when I get on different bikes, it takes me a while to get my gearing in sync with the bike that I'm on. And I guess my question is, if there's anything more that we should know about gearing and efficiency that you haven't yet mentioned. And then secondarily, it sounds like for most transportation cyclists like myself or people who are doing recreational riding, that it would be a good idea to get some additional education or help in your gearing so that you can reach that efficiency that you might want.
Yes. There's a huge amount to know about efficiency of the human body on bicycles. And as I say, there must be 3 or 4 academic papers on the subject published every week. But for transportation cyclists, for commuters, for going shopping and so on, put simply, the faster your legs are moving, the more efficient you're using your energy resources. If you're in too high a gear and you're really having to push slowly and struggle to keep a certain speed, then you're in the wrong gear. Change down and get your legs moving much faster. You'll travel at the same speed as before and you'll be able to keep cycling for longer.
Okay, that's good to know.
Well, somehow our time is almost up. So before we say goodbye, Max Glaskin, I'd like to ask you about the bike ballet. And we have about a minute or two here.
I'll be very quick then. Yes, I was lucky. I volunteered to take part in a bicycle ballet company here in my hometown of Brighton in the UK. And it was coordinated movements on, I guess there was about 20 bicycles and 20 cyclists. There were 4 professional dancers involved. And we did this dance down on the seafront in Brighton. And we did it a couple of times. The next thing we heard, we were commissioned to do it for Her Majesty the Queen Elizabeth II on her visit to Brighton. And I had to do my solo with my bicycle, which is rather possibly lewd. And shortly after I did my piece, she turned away and went back inside the building from her balcony.
Oh, no.
I was hoping you would say that she decided to resign and leave the monarchy and abolish the monarchy, but I guess you need to do some more of those ballets.
I wish she'd done so too. She did turn down the invitation to join the naked bike ride.
Oh, I bet.
Well, you've been listening to The Bike Show, broadcasting from the KBO studio in Portland, Oregon, and all shows are also available as podcasts. And my name is Alon Rob. I would like to thank our guests, Sarah Dykman and Max Glaskin, both for providing insightful and enlightening and inspiring conversation. Also for the listener, Mike, who called. Thank you, Max, for sharing your knowledge, love of cycling, and all the best to you. And thank you also to my co-host, April Streeter, to our engineer, Tammy Dean. All the best in the fall.
Thanks, Max.
It takes 2 wheels and no gasoline to keep yourself healthy and to keep the air clean. You can ride in the sunshine, you can ride in the rain.
It's 11:59, and time for jazz. It'll be coming up shortly after the news and a couple of announcements. Thanks for taking care of KBOO with your membership, and thank you for listening.
Get on your bicycle. Let's get together to pedal and roam.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Personnel Committee will meet on the second Monday of each month at 6 p.m.
KBOO is excited to be part of the 2018 Willamette Week Give Guide. This year, Willamette Week and KBOO are challenging our community to give with their dollars and take action by showing up in real life. KBOO has been showing up for over 50 years. Give to KBOO today and you get full access to the Chinook Book app, plus freebies from Laughing Planet, Gluten-Free Gem, Wee Press, and Nosa Familia Coffee. You can contribute right now at kboo.fm/give or call 503-231-8032. Support KBOO, where music makes the movement.
It's time for the KBOO News at Noon for Wednesday, November 7th, 2018. In the latest midterm election results, Democrats have retaken control of the House of Representatives in Washington, D.C., while Republicans have increased their lead in the Senate. There were a number of national wins for progressives and people of color and several firsts. Ayanna Pressley won her House race in Massachusetts, becoming the state's first black woman elected to Congress. Alexandria